Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in. Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series episode by episode.
This week, we discuss Release Me, written by Ryle Tucker and directed by Michael Ruscio, who also happens to be the series editor.
It's episode 207.
Yay!
Yay! And our characters are trapped, both emotionally and literally, and only the truth can set them free. So we'll talk about all the drama, both past and present, and let you in on some behind-the-scenes secrets.
Then we have the effervescent Mariana Clavino with us to share all her stories about playing the infamous Lorena, maker of the broodiest of vampires, Bill Compton. Mariana was only 4 years into her professional film career when she booked the breakout role, and she hasn't slowed down since, with series regular and recurring roles on Devious Maids, Stalker, Designated Survivor, and the upcoming Superman and Lois.
She is a vision, and it's all about her and Bill this week on True Blood.
A drunk and muddy Andy Belfler, in search of a pig, stumbles upon Marianne's orgy. He manages enough of a distraction, allowing Sam to escape her clutches. Unfortunately, Andy and Sam are the last standing in Bon Temps as all their friends and neighbors are caught under Marianne's spell. But finally, Sam gets some answers from Daphne.
What the fuck is she?
She's God, dum-dum.
Daphne professes her love to Marianne, who repays that love with a dagger to Daphne's heart, wielded by an enchanted eggs.
Back in Dallas, Eric is losing patience with Godric's vampire underlings, and Sookie has been gone too long. She and Hugo are locked in the church basement. When Steve Newland discovers her connection to Jason, things go from bad to worse. Meanwhile, in sweeter news, Hoyt and Jessica are having a sleepover.
Oh, we could cuddle, if you like. Just don't freak out if I look a little dead.
After sharing the respective sex histories, or lack thereof, they agree to be each other's firsts.
In the hopefully soundproof room next door, Lorena continues to keep Bill from going to Sookie's rescue. They pass the day recalling the last time they were together. Bill had grown into his vampire adolescence and no longer wanted to spend eternity killing people with his mommy.
William Compton, you're still so sensitive. Some might say it's a weakness, but I've always found it oddly cute.
So desperate to free himself from her hold, he actually placed a stake to his own heart. To save his life, Lorena let him go, releasing her magical hold on him as his maker.
In the church balcony, Jason and Sarah try to reckon with their infidelity. Sarah, by dreaming of becoming Mrs. Stackhouse, and Jason, thinking mostly about Steve and all his guns. When Steve instead threatens him because of Sookie, Jason needs a minute to catch up.
I know who you are and who you're working for.
The road crew?
With his sister in danger, Jason goes full-blown action hero and escapes from Steve, only to be shot in the heart by an enraged Sarah Newland. In the basement, Sookie is viciously attacked by Steve's henchman, Gabe, but is rescued just in time by a skinny, tattooed, 15-year-old boy named Godric. So, Hoyt and Jess are so freaking adorable.
Well, we're the only ones having a good time right now, I feel like.
And you are having the sweetest, best time. Yeah. And there was so much sweet stuff in the commentary about you two. Like when Michael Ruscio, the director, yeah, and the writer Ryle Tucker were talking, when you two came on screen, they go, aww.
They both went, aww.
It was really, really cute.
Which
and
is
they
great.
Say,
yeah.
They say, aww, we love them. They're so cute, moving, loving, and refreshing, and completely compelling and believable. And aww. Here I'm really going to embarrass you. Because Rael says,
"Oh no,
Rucio, Deb seems to glow. I've never seen anything like it." And they're going back and forth. One of them says she's beautiful in person, but the camera, she's like a 30s movie star.
Oh, that's so nice. That's
it's so, so nice.
They mentioned it, and I think it's cute that Hoyt and Jess are kind of like the poster kids for how to lose your virginity. Sort of open conversation, the consent, the sweetness, but also the enthusiasm and excitement for it. Because I remember one thing that Jim and I decided to do, because in the script, it actually starts with like them just sitting on the bed talking and she's still got the flowers. And we were like, I don't know, when you're a teenager, do you remember like you could just make out for like hours, right? Like you could just mac on each other until your lips were chapped, right? Like that's such a teenager-y thing. And so we were like, I feel like we should hop in on them having just like marathon makeout.
Yes.
And then let it kind of break apart with Hoyt having to be like, I need to tell you something because I can't keep doing this for much longer.
And I love a couple of things. Yeah. One is, was this the scene in the commentary they said that you and Jim wanted to rehearse it like a theater scene?
We've rehearsed a lot of things. So I think actually the rehearse like a theater scene is coming up in the next episode.
Okay.
Jim and I rehearsed almost every scene we ever did together because we enjoy that process.
Great. You found stuff.
Yeah, we found stuff. And I think also it allowed us to get really comfortable with one another. You know, and I can share this now, I think, and Jim and I talk about it a little bit later as well when we speak with him in our interview. He and I were in relationships and we didn't want to sacrifice or make them uncomfortable in any way, but we also wanted to tell a really believable and true love story. And so we actually had a conversation, you know, feelings come up when you do scenes like this and the appropriate feelings, the kind of like young love feelings. And they're real, but they're also based on fiction, you know, so you have to keep a very level head about it. And, you know, Jim and I had a very frank conversation about how we were gonna be totally accepting of those feelings, but we were only gonna act on them from action to cut, right? So that everything else outside, even during rehearsals, was gonna be very above board, very respectful of our other relationships, but we were gonna take advantage of the fact that one naturally kind of has these feelings arise and let that be really present during the actual scenes. And I think that that really made for a beautiful relationship on camera.
It does. And I think, you know, because I had that with Alex in not a romantic way, but I always felt like how lucky.
Yeah.
Right? Because you could be in a scene with someone that you don't have any of that kismet with.
Yeah.
But you can borrow from your real feelings.
Yes. And it means that how you feel wonderful. It's really exciting, right? Every time action is called, you're like, oh, you know, we get to sort of live in this space that we've agreed on that's very safe. And really go for it. You know, it's not going to be the awkward, like, oh, is it okay? Or can I, we've rehearsed, we've had these conversations. We already know exactly what, and then it's interesting because I look at that and I think, oh, that's the kind of work an intimacy coordinator does, which is sort of a new addition to our business. We didn't have that back in the days that we were shooting this, but the work that Jim and I were doing was that work. It was the kind of, sharing and managing of expectations and things like that, being really clear about what boundaries were. It was a great, great thing. And especially when it's emotionally vulnerable as well, because, you know, Hoyt and Jessica both have to share some very emotionally scary stuff this episode.
I know. And throughout, you know. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It feels so much better as an actor when you're not entirely just living in your own head.
Yes.
But you're playing a you know, I'm a tennis watcher. So it's like you're hitting the ball back and forth with someone.
Right.
And
right.
It just raises your game, right? And you're in a flow and you're feeling it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the camera picks up on it. But whether or not it does, you do.
Yes.
So you go home going, wow, I really made something with somebody.
Yeah. And in a way, as an actor, I feel like that has to matter the most to you. Just did you have an experience? Did they have an experience? And kind of go, well, I hope they caught it, you know?
Exactly. The rest is out of my hands. Moving on, you know? This clip is really cute because I love what you say in it. And I don't want to ruin it. But like, it's just such a teen, and I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to bring this back and say this in my life.
I ain't never done it. With a girl, I mean.
What have you done it with?
Just myself.
Oh, so you're a virgin. Oh.
Well, big whoop, so am I.
Big whoop.
It's Ryle Tucker, really, who's fantastic. I just love that she misunderstands him, but he's like, I've never done it with a girl. And she's like, oh no. What does that mean? What have you done it
with?
What have you done it with? He has to come back from that somehow.
Somehow, and you know, you can only come back halfway because then you have to go, well, just with myself, you know. And it's like, oh, okay, let's not talk about that right now.
Poor Hoyt.
Like, right?
But
poor Hoyt.
But then again, in that moment, and this is again why I think this is brilliant. So yes, that I'm with you. You can only come back about halfway from that. But then what's amazing is because I'm sure in Hoyt's heart, he's going, every girl's going to think it's a big whoop that I'm a virgin. They're all going to think I'm such a freak and a weirdo. And she instead goes, big whoop, right?
Big
whoop. So in a way, he can only come back halfway, but she brings him back the rest of the way, I think, Jessica. And,
totally.
And they're right back on the same page, which is why they can agree to be each other's first. You know, she says, I'm not like other girls. I'd happily be your first if you'd like.
Aww.
Yeah. Aww.
See, that's why we all do that.
And then we have the most adorable scene coming up with Hoyt has gotten up early to set up the room to make it special with blood / soup scented candles.
I know that line is funny too. To me, they smell like soup.
And we have a very famous song called Bleeding Love playing during this scene, which is pretty perfect and became kind of a Hoyt and Jessica anthem. Every time I hear it, I think of them, or at least I think of Jim, which is fun.
Sure.
But the interesting thing for it is it was written by a man for a man to sing. It was written by Ryan Tedder of One Republic and Jesse McCartney for McCartney's next album. And I always like that because when I really listen to the lyrics, it does sound like a teenage boy's diary. But it turns out the record company didn't really like it. So when Tedder...
They were like, this sounds like a teenage boy's diary.
So when they had heard Leona Lewis, who had just been on X Factor, and they rearranged it for her, loved her voice, and it debuted at number one, and it was on the charts, and like kind of unbeaten for a while for a British female solo artist. So it became this huge hit when they sort of rearranged it for a woman's voice, which I think is really fun.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So interesting. And then because we had this huge budget, they could get
actual song. Yeah, like that. So it's cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
Then we also have some fun stuff going on in Bon Temps with Marianne and all those enchanted people there.
We sure do. We sure do. There's a couple funny tidbits.
Yes, tidbits. All
so
right.
So what do you think of that? Did you catch that?
I caught that. Some tidbits. So we can start with, let's see. I think Andy, first of all, sort of sums up what's happening in Bon Temps very well. He accomplishes it all in about a quarter of a page.
I love him.
With a bull mask and these giant claws.
Claws? Uh-huh.
And the whole town had these big black saucer eyes like zombies.
It's such a short scene. And it's so, like, the lens that they use is almost like that fisheye lens that he looks a little bugged out, you know? It's so great.
That is so great. He really sums it up because the whole town has gone nuts.
Crazy.
And Andy... who we thought was nuts,
right?
Now is
the only sane
accurate. He's the only one who's completely accurate. Yeah.
Well, versus the scene with Daphne and Sam on the dock, where I do not envy Ashley Jones, who has to take this all this exposition and somehow make it this, you know, really intense, cool drama. And I think she and Sam did a really good job of sort of, you know, making that, you know, kind of Manson girl, you know, kind of obsessive cult dialogue really work.
You know, I'm obsessed with that lake pond thing because, and I don't know if we can say this enough, but that thing is filled with water only when we're shooting in it and they heat it and it costs $1 billion, a gazillion dollars, and it's only 3 feet deep. So, right? So like, And the prosthetics on her back would fall apart if she was in the water for too long. So they did that part first.
Well, and you can see, they're shooting to avoid her back as best as they can.
Totally.
So they don't have to.
Totally. You can totally see it.
Well, and my favorite is they're on them. She goes to go jump in the water and they pan the camera away because she can't actually jump in the water. It's too shallow.
No, it's too shallow.
So there's this amazing sound effect of a dive that is completely Foley. Yes. It's just faked in.
Completely Foley. Yeah. And it's amazing how it works. Yes. You know, we buy it.
We totally buy it because then it pans over and she's in the water. So I love that, you know, while the camera's off her, Ashley is scrambling to get in the water as quick as she can.
Yes.
And look like she dived.
But she does such a great job paddling around in this water. Yeah.
Sharing all of the dark secrets that we finally get to know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, speaking, she's spilling secrets about Marianne, the Maenad. We now have a name for what Marianne is, or God, if you want that.
Yeah.
So speaking of her, we have this moment with Mishka the vegan and the dead rabbit.
Yeah. Mishka the vegan.
There's an interesting tidbit about that, if you'd like to share, Kristen.
Mm-hmm. Do you see? It's catching on. I told you. Just saying. Yeah, so Mishka the vegan. Mishka and I like to go and have vegan meals and talk all things vegan. And I did not know about this. This is so cool. So they did get some roadkill, and we're going to use that. But they also got, for her, like a PETA-approved fake dead rabbit.
Yeah.
And that one ended up looking better.
Yeah. So that's the one
they use. And they said Mishka was game for whatever needed to be done. But you also found out that, because, you know, she's got to cut up that heart.
Yep.
And then they've got to be eating this stew. So apparently was it episode 2 or 3 or 4? The meat stew is spooned out by Carl. The camera pans away and a prop person switches out the spoon for a veggie version before the camera gets back to her.
So I believe, you know, Carl's at the stove and he spoons out this big heaping thing with a bunch of, you know, meat in it, gives it to her. As she brings it to her lips, the camera goes away to find Tara. Meanwhile, while Rutina's trying not to laugh, someone has run in with another spoon that only has veggies on it and switched it out so that when they turn back to Mishka, she's got the veggie version.
They're so good with us.
So good.
You know, I didn't have to eat for 7 years on this show, but I have had to.
Yes, it's
hard. It's hard. It's hard. And it's awful.
But in the same vein of like respect towards animals, and we will do a whole deep dive on this because we worked with a lot of animals on the show.
Yeah.
But for now, you know, animals have a ton of rights and stuff when you use an animal actor. So in this one, we have an owl.
Not enough, but yes.
The owl came with multiple handlers to make sure that everything was on the up and up. Her name was Periwinkle. She had a close-up. They were shooting, and apparently she got 3 good takes in, and something spooked her.
Yeah.
And again, because it's very important, the handlers had everyone stay absolutely silent for 30 minutes while Periwinkle got it together and did one last take. And I think in the end, unfortunately, they didn't actually use that footage.
Yeah.
They only used the flyaway.
Rael said something along the lines of, "This is the weirdest show on television. A 4-foot owl, a woman covered in mud with claws, chasing someone down the road, yelling at him like he's a dog.
Who's naked.
This is the best job in the world."
And it is. But also sometimes it's a really hard job. We'll move into Alexander Skarsgård this episode, who was dreadfully ill.
Like scary ill.
Like scary, like we need to shoot him out and get him home kind of sick.
Mm-hmm. Rael said he was worried.
Yeah, yeah.
She was worried about him. Like he was having to lean on the wall.
Yeah, you can see he's a little slower on his feet and holding the wand. Now, this is a daytime episode for vampires, and he's very emotional missing his maker. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting that that kind of coincided, and that in a way, the vulnerability of being sick didn't work against him in this moment because he didn't have to be big and powerful.
So
it's an interesting thing to sort of watch that performance back and go, oh, you know, he really does seem vulnerable. And he was personally in that moment.
He does. And, you know, back in the day, in the before times, you just worked sick.
Yeah.
I mean, if you weren't bleeding out, you were on that set.
Yep.
And because it costs like our show, I think, was around $350,000 to reschedule a day. Yeah. And so they'd have to file an insurance claim.
Well, and that's the thing. And like, with an actor, you can't get a substitute. You can't get somebody else to come do it because it's your face. So when an actor is sick, you have to reschedule around it. And normally...
Yeah, you got to have like a hospital note for them to get that insurance. Yeah. But now I think I've heard that if you're sick, they're like, oh my God, stay home.
You know, at this point, it's not necessarily a bad thing that we now start offering a bit more support for when actors are not feeling well.
Right. And now for a quick bite. Vampire 101, The Bleeds.
Are you a vampire unable to stay awake during the day? Do you find your strength and energy sapped, resulting in elegant lounging on white leather furniture? Do your ears and nose begin to leak blood? Are you prone to nausea and dramatic monologuing?
If this sounds like you, you might be suffering from the bleeds. Hello, I am Pamela Swinford de Beaufort, creator of New Blood, and we have an answer for you. Try our new O-negative AM for those nights when you need just a few more hours. A new blend, entirely organic, derived from the genetic material of humans annoyingly self-described as early risers. It'll get you out of the coffin and back in business.
New Blood O-negative AM does not provide protection from the sun. Younger vampires may need a larger dosage to see results. If your bleeds persist for longer than 4 days, please consult Dr. Ludwig.
So one thing that I thought was so interesting, Deb, was that this Bill and Lorena, I mean, these flashbacks are so insane. And we talk about them with Mariana.
Yes. Later this episode, stick around. It's incredible.
Yeah. It's such an incredible interview. She's so remarkable. But there was some interesting things in the commentary that I wouldn't have thought of. And one is that this is the episode that establishes what happens to a vampire when they don't get to sleep.
Yes. We start with the bleeds. Yeah.
So I don't think I clocked that was invented on True Blood, that you start bleeding.
Yes. Specifically from the ears and nose. And what's really a fun, you know, behind the scenes bit of that is that the ear blood is very easy to forget about when you're taking your makeup off. So the number of times I've gone to the grocery store after I've wrapped shooting with blood in my ears and I see like the checkout person staring at me and I'm like, what? And they're like, are you okay? Because they think I've had a stroke and I'm bleeding from my ears. And I have to go, no. I'm an actor.
You know? Yes. And you know, they also would often put it on with the blood that is paint, basically, that's alcohol-based. So you've got to remove it with alcohol.
You can't just wipe it with a washcloth.
Yeah, you can't. You shower and it's still there.
Yeah.
Right. And then if I was also, after a while, if I was working again the next day, I wouldn't even try or care. And it's down in your ear.
Well, I mean, but like, again, days later, using a Q-tip and being like, oh, that's still there. How do I get rid of this?
Last month, I found some, Deb.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, it really, I really need to bathe more. But I thought that whole sequence was so stunning. And to hear them talk about it, on how they kept simplifying it and simplifying it because it was supposed to be like a fight, you know, and heavy stunts.
Lots of like flying across the room and more vamp speed. And both, you know, we've got this like twin conversation going. We've got, you know, present day with Bill and Lorena now, and then the past, their sort of divorce, really. And so in both of those worlds, they had all of this vamp speed and flying and throwing and breaking things. And they said the more and more they looked at it, the writer and the director, and then bringing in Steve and Mariana, the more and more they wanted the intensity to be between the two of them. So obviously there is still some physicality to it, but I love how connected they are. It's devastating. Yeah.
It's really devastating. And after having talked to Mariana, and again, she'll really go into this, but then also hearing Rael, I really see another side of this where I just feel for Lorena because
really
she has been hopelessly in love with someone for over 100 years.
Yes. Well, and there's this really, the end of their flashback scene is really so devastating.
Oh,
You know I don't love you.
You have never tried.
I have spent decades trying. I despise myself for what I did for you. God help me. I killed innocent people to prove to you that I loved you. But it was pure nihilism. I do not. I cannot. I will never love you.
Oh, God.
And her face is just devastating. And what it reminds me of, because, you know, we started this season with the opposite from Pill, with a declaration of love for Sookie. And it's fascinating. I don't know if she did it on purpose, Rael, or if it's just the way Bill speaks, but he uses some very similar language. End of the first episode, he says, "I will not and cannot lose you. I felt something I thought was lost to me forever. I love you." And it's literally like what Lorena is just wanting to hear more than anything in the world. And instead she gets the opposite.
Oh, it's so painful. Yeah. We've all, probably all of us have experienced it. And almost every movie and TV show has this element in it. Every song, right? It's just one of the more painful things in human existence, right? So and think about, you know, I've been devastated after a relationship ended after 3 years. 100 years. Ugh. Well, and, you know, one of the themes that they talk about, the writer and the director, is this concept of being trapped.
Yes. That a number of our characters are confined, literally. Bill is being held. Sookie's being held. Jason is being held. But it is also this emotional trapping, right? I mean, they're...
Yeah.
Lorena is trapped by her feelings for Bill, I would say, in many ways. But one thing that fascinates me is the way they're actually using the camera and things to really establish that feeling so that we as watchers also feel that kind of claustrophobic feeling, especially with Bill and Lorena. It's these really close shots where the whole frame is filled with their bodies or their face. And everything in the background is very blurry. So you feel like you're very tight. And then there's this incredible shot, but from outside the window of the hotel. And Ruscio describes it as four shots in one, because you now don't have to do coverage of that moment. It's, you can get all that you need in the one shot. But it's the frame, the cell of that window that you know, frames them in, traps them in there. Bill, Lorena in the background, and then the reflection of the city skyline in the window. It's a really gorgeous shot. So I recommend, if you are watching through, that you really kind of take notice of that.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And so much care goes into setting up shots like that.
Yeah. So we also have Sookie.
Yeah,
in literal jail in the church camp basement.
Yeah. And they talked about how they filmed that they wanted to not put the camera on the other side of that fence so that we would be seeing them as if they were in the jail. And they make a very conscious choice when they put the camera inside that barrier.
Yeah. So when Steve and Sookie are talking, it's always through the fence. And then when Sookie and Hugo are talking, we're now inside, but we're always seeing the fence and the walls around them, which is really fascinating. And then it's a great moment, and most actors will understand this kind of technical thing. But there's a moment when the camera pushes in on Sookie through the chain link fence. And you can just sense, like, keep her eyes in the holes, you know, like don't let a bar cross over her eye line, because we want to see her eyes right to the end. And that's a really, like, threading the needle kind of shot. So, you know, big props to Simon Jays, who I'm sure managed to keep that steady for them.
Yeah. And it's a thing for the actor, because you can kind of feel it.
Yes.
But you can't, of course, look down the lens to see if you're in the right spot.
Exactly.
And, you know, Rael, and throughout the commentary, Rael and Michael Ruscio talk about how brilliant Anna is.
Yes.
I mean, she's just such a consummate performer and hits all these emotional notes, but yet is, I mean, that incredible sequence at the end, you know, that
so
brutal
hard
attack.
I mean, it must be so hard as a writer to mm-hmm. write something like that and then go, oh God, someone actually has to enact that. And I know Rael talking about really wanting it to be hard to watch, that it shouldn't mm-hmm. be funny or sexy or anything like mm-hmm. that, that it's really, this is a horrific moment and it should feel horrifying.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying. Mm-hmm. And then the relief and the surprise.
Yeah.
When Godric appears is extreme.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. it's a great button to that, you know, episode, because this is, you know, we've been looking for him for so long.
Yeah.
And it's great, you know, to know that, you know, he wasn't trapped. Of all of our characters, he was.
Right. That's a good point.
Potentially there of his own free will, because if he can just get into that cell, he's got more freedom than we thought he did.
Just a side note about just a little tidbit. It'll catch on. The games that the art department, I mean, the art mm-hmm. department is so unbelievable. It's so seamless. You don't even
yes.
notice it.
Yes. Which,
with all the professionals on this show. But those games that they create, right?
Right. Jesus Christ, Vampire Exterminator, Silver and Stakes, and Send Him Back to Hell, which is pretty great. Pieces there, which I love. And then finally we have Jason, who, yeah. you know, I think is first trapped emotionally. And we'll talk about that, because he's just slept with Sarah, a married woman, in the balcony of her husband's church.
Sure. Sure.
And she immediately professes her love.
I thought I loved Steve, but I never even knew what love was until you just showed me.
Wow, that's intense, huh?
I know.
He didn't see that coming.
See that coming. I mean, she's in love. She's ready to just, she's like, well, we'll tell him. We'll leave. We'll spend the rest of our life together. I love that he's like, that's intense. She's like, I know.
You know, two people having polar opposite experiences.
God. Well, because
oh, that's a little intense. She's so happy about it.
And then Jason replies when she's like, we have to tell Steve. And it's so wonderful.
Let's just think about this for a second. A, Steve has guns. Then there's the lockdown tomorrow night. And secondly, we're going to be locked in this church with Steve and his guns all night.
I mean, he's talking sense.
He is talking sense. It's very, Steve is a dangerous person.
Yeah.
And then what's even more fun is, of course, this episode ends with actually not Steve and a gun, but Sarah and a gun.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. She shoots him.
Yes.
In the heart.
In the heart. And, you know, we'll find out next week what comes of that. But mm-hmm. before that happens, Jason has quite an arc this episode. You know, he's sort of kidnapped by Steve and Gabe. And they have this really intense scene where he's got a knife to his throat and they're, you know, sort mm-hmm. of interviewing him and they're misunderstanding each other. Jason thinks it's about Sarah and Steve thinks it's about Sookie. And that's a really fun and
that's a fun scene
thing. And apparently, so Michael shared that they had actually shot that scene with a lot more movement and a lot more sort of bigger choices. And they shot quite a bit of it. And the actors actually came back and said, it's not really working for us. Can we try it a bit more contained? And again, to True Blood's credit, they said, all right, even though that makes what we've done before not usable, let's do it. And what they yeah. ended up using is what's in the show now, which is this much more intense, confined conversation. So I'm always so impressed with the trust and respect that mm-hmm. production had for each member of its, you know, of the cast and crew. And then we have, I'd love to just throw it out to Greg Collins, who plays Gabe. So
yep.
Greg is was a professional football player.
Yeah.
He was a linebacker. He played for the San Francisco 49ers, the Seattle Seahawks, and my father's hometown team, the Buffalo Bills. He also played mm-hmm. in college for Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing they said is that, so, you know, Gabe, the character, is this horrible, mean, angry, vicious person. But Greg himself is the nicest guy you'd ever meet. that he was such a joy and a pleasure to have on set. And the only trouble they ever had with him was that sometimes he was too nice as Gabe.
Right.
And they had to sort of encourage him to be more evil, which is just such a, you know, if you're going to have to give someone a note more than once, it better be that one.
Yes, that is so funny.
At the end of the day, the interesting thing about all of these people who are trapped, right?
Yeah.
Is that at the end, what they really needed to hear was truth. And that is the only thing that's going to allow them to be able to escape. Because look, for Bill and Lorena, she is stronger than him. She is older than him. She is faster than him. She even says it. But the only way he's going to be able to get out there is by having these conversations with her about the truth of their relationship and the truth of where he is now. When we get to Sookie and Hugo in the jail, right? Hugo does some real truth talking about what it is to be the human companion to a vampire, and that is not all it's cracked up to be. That she is sitting here in a jail and no one has come to get her. And, you know, I think those realizations that she's actually kind of on her own is, you know, that's what she's going to need to learn going forward on this. And then Jason and Sarah, you know, they have this big... this big secret about who they are, you know? I mean, at the end of the day, they don't really know each other. You know, they think that they're on the same page with vampire hating and their feelings for one another, but they are on opposite pages. Yeah. And, you know, I think by the end of this with her shooting him, things will be a little clearer.
Yeah, things will be a little clearer to both of them. And then we have Godric, who, you know, we've spent seven episodes thinking, trying to find him, thinking that he was being held against his will. And he's there fine. And now I am so excited to introduce the interview with Mariana Clavino. Oh, she is just absolutely unbelievable as Lorena. She's also a friend. She's so funny. I love seeing her. This interview is just delicious for me.
I can't wait to hear how Lorena came to be.
Yes. Oh, and did she come to be?
Hi, Mariana.
Hello.
Hi,
Mariana.
It is so nice to see your faces.
Me too. It's been so long.
It is so nice.
Very,
to see
very
you.
Long.
But we've been staring at your face quite a bit recently. So.
I know.
It's decidedly less smiley.
Sorry? Apologies?
No, never apologize for Lorena. Never apologize for Lorena.
Joy.
I mean, it's been so much fun. And I don't know if Kristen shared with you or not, but she and I, this is sort of our first time watching the series. So because you and I didn't work together, I didn't actually end up seeing very much of your work. So for me, this is like, oh my God, she's so amazing.
Well, thank you, but you never watched the show when it was really.
No, I don't watch my own work. So this is a nightmare. Yeah.
This is a
Doing this podcast is a waking nightmare.
Nightmare.
but what it means is that the highlight really is watching all of these people that I know and love and who I've seen their work in person.
Yeah.
But to now sort of see what all together that culmination is. I mean, gosh, Lorena is fascinating and so complex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we think of her as a villain.
Yes.
But boy, is there a lot more going on than that.
I always liked to think so.
I mean, we can jump in with, do we want to start with how you got the part?
So it was an audition that came in just like any of the many auditions that we get. I just knew it was Alan Ball's new show for HBO, and that's all I needed, you know to get super excited about it. And I remember having the instinct that, and you know, I don't always get strong instincts with audition material. I don't know about you guys. Sometimes it's just sort of like, whatever. But this, I had a really strong instinct that I should not play it safe. I just sort of felt like, I feel like this is a part slash character slash show where it's not going to serve me to be timid or safe. Like I need to be bold. So I made some choices that probably weren't, as we say, I was never going to play it that way on the day, but I kind of wanted to, which in a lot of auditions you do, you go in and you play it exactly how you would play it on the day, which is what we say when you're actually going to film it. But I sort of felt like they need to be able to see where I'm willing to take this character.
Right.
And so I kind of pushed it in terms of her being a little unhinged and far more in touch with her emotions than I think we're used to seeing vampires. And so I really kind of made some bold choices. And I went in there looking as innocent as I possibly could. I mean, I curled my hair into like little sweet ringlets and I wore like a little lace top.
Oh my God. Because it would be the period, right? It was the Civil War era scene. Yeah.
And I felt, how much more frightening it is to experience that turn and as an actor, you know, be able to serve that turn, not just have it be, you know, coming in like a vampire. What was funny is that I get there and all of the other actors, not to disparage my fellow actors out there, they all looked like Elvira. Like they were all dressed up, totally gothed up, red lipstick. Like they were dressed up like vampires and I was the only one, at least at that time, who didn't look like that. And I barely wore any makeup. Like I was just sweet, 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 sweet. And
were you thinking, oh shit? Or were you thinking, okay, you know, good choice?
Normally I do think, oh shit, because I've definitely been on the other side of, oh, I got this one wrong. Like everybody else, like.
Right.
But this was maybe the rare occasion where I was like, yeah, I don't think that's right, guy. Like I feel like, like this is where she is. So I went in and I read with Junie and Libby, the best casting directors in the biz.
Yes.
And Alex Wu was there. Ugh. And I think it went well. And I think we did it maybe a couple times or something. And then they brought me back in and it was just back in for producers. I didn't know Alan was going to be there, but he was there. And I think some of the other writers, and that was it. And I just went in. I think Alan had a couple notes for me and I redid it. And then I waited a few days and then I got the good news. But it was only a guest star possible recurring at that point.
Right. Right.
And then when after season one, we got the magical call that they were asking me to join the cast. And so it was like
the magical,
such call. A magical call. Yeah. I was just like hoping that I would get brought back for, you know, another guest star or something. It was like, no, we want you to join the cast. I'm like, what?
Well, Alex Wu, interviewed him and the word that I remember for you was luminous. Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Isn't that a great word? Oh, I know. But you really, really, really are.
Oh, thank you.
As Lorena in that first season, we covered it in the season one of this podcast, but it really was fantastic that we do not see the vampire Lorena coming. And then in season two here, this episode, 207, there's so much in the whole season.
The entrance. I think we have to start with the entrance.
We got to start with
I went
the
back
entrance.
And reread the script. And I mean, they set you up. I mean, they were like,
they did.
The dress, the earrings, the necklace, the music. They were like, we want to give Mariana every, you know, advantage in this moment. And boy, does that entrance down that hallway just sing.
Thank you.
The slow-mo. Yeah.
You know what?
And the way your face
What is that? Is that pressure? Like, you think, like, isn't this great? But maybe it's like, how do I live up to this?
Honestly, that shot took so many takes because it was like, you think that that's like going to be the easiest thing to just like stroll down, like power walk with the fans blowing. And then to stop, because I think it was scripted that I have like some sort of evil look on my face or something. I forget how it was scripted. I think it just wasn't working and then it just was looking silly or so, I don't know. And finally the director gave me like a great little nugget, which was just like, just think about him. Just think. Like, don't, you know, be evil. And I was like freaked out. I think it was the first thing I shot. I was like all freaked out. Like,
right.
And so then it was a much more sort of like pensive, you know, look, which worked so much better than any of the other schlock I was serving up in the previous takes. But I think, I think that look like took so many takes. And it was like right before lunch. And I was just like already like internally panicking, like, oh God, I'm not getting this. I'm not getting this.
Oh no.
Right. What ended up happening was a moment that was captured forever.
They really did give me moments, silhouettes, costumes, the costumes.
I mean, we'll get into it because your flashback stuff.
Audrey
Fisher, you're really
the
queen of flashbacks on this show. Although I want to say this right before we go on because I found the script here. So yes, it's Lorena walks down the broad hall outside their room, maybe in slow-mo. Dressed in something that flows and a 1930s style necklace, she hears Sookie and Bill making love with her super vampire hearing. Lorena stops walking, smiles, wicked, flashing fang. And that's the, like,
The wicked smile yeah. just sort of was not whatever I was serving up was not working, and it took some direction to get me.
It's exciting.
Pulled back
so
in.
Before we jump totally into the flashback scenes, because that's on the screen. The one fascinating thing to me about Lorena, and correct me if I'm wrong, we know nothing about her human life.
Nothing.
What did you did you want to come up with something, or was that okay with you?
I did come up with a history of my own that I don't feel a little shy sharing, but I just will say, like, it felt right to me that she had a very difficult human life and that she was brutalized and exploited and really hurt by men in her human life, which then really informs her just tragic search for love in her vampire life. And she, of course, wants the one vampire who proved himself to be honorable and has, you know, kind of been able to maintain his humanity in a way. And that's preventing him from ever loving her. So it's like she wants the thing that will never love her back. And that's kind of her tragedy to me. So I always saw her as such a tragic character. I just... always like wanted to just like hold her if I, you know, stepped outside of her for a moment. Just, oh, sweetie, you're so broken. You are so broken.
So broken.
Because she just wanted, she wanted that love, and she wanted it from somebody who was good. Somebody good was never going to love her. Like, she could have gotten someone to adore her who was, you know, a jerk vampire, but that's not what she wanted. I think she wanted... what she never had in her human life. Anyway, that's kind of where I was coming from.
Well, it's all in there. I feel like that. I mean, I practically transcribed one of the scenes from this episode, because he says, "You are the saddest, loneliest creature I've ever known."
Yeah.
And she says in there, "Men have readily laid down their lives just to spend one night with me. What more can I give? What is it that you want from me?" She really wants this one. I mean, how painful.
So painful.
How excruciating. For all her backstory, she wants love from this
one person. And I would always...
And he's not, going to love
her. He's never going to love her. And I would always say that to, like, in interviews or whatever, when people would ask me about the love triangle, so to speak, which was never really a triangle because Bill was never interested in me, but I said, you know what? She's loyal. You know, Sookie gets tempted by Sam and other people come around. I'm like, Lorena, she was one man the whole time. Say what you will.
All Bill all day.
She was all Bill all day. But no, you're right. I think that she to me was just so tragic for whatever reason, you know, that he represented everything that could make it all better for her and could really fix her, I think, and fill that hole. And it was just never going to work. And that scene, yes, that scene, God, I remember in that green dress. In that green dress.
That dress. That green dress.
Yeah, I think Marco Ruscio, I think, who directed that episode, talked about, he was like, we wanted the Anne Bancroft moment for Lorena, where, like, it's that super slinky slip dress where you can see her abs acting, you know? Like, you can see the breath dropping.
The breath dropping.
You know, all of that. And it's funny because after hearing that, I was like, I'm watching that scene and you are acting like from your fingertips out of every pore. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you hit every color, every emotion in that scene. And so much of True Blood was, we just interviewed Romeo Tarone yesterday. And he talks about how there was never really scenes with two people. And I'm like, yeah, most of your scenes were two people and you were with Steven acting your balls off and having quite a relationship. Yeah. And that scene, boy, it covers, I mean, you have so many great arcs in this series, But that scene for me has every color of that relationship.
In that whole episode, I think it's 207, right? I think which is you guys are you're trapped in that hotel room. We're getting the flashbacks to the 30 with the release and all of these, you know, torturous moments that are happening. I mean, the whole episode really feels like a Bill Lorena love story and divorce, right? All in one. And I love to hear your take on it.
For her to release him was so big, and it was just I don't know that I ever quite I never felt like I really nailed it. Like we did it many times, and I just never felt like I really got there. I'm glad that you feel that it was there on screen. And it's funny to think about, oh, it's a sexy vampire show, but man, the emotional roller coasters that we would go on. I don't know that I've gone on them in any other show that I've worked on to that extent, where you go to so many places and the stakes are so high. Pardon the pun.
You're not the first to make it.
It's just, you know, it truly was a gymnastics, you know, kind of acting gymnastics in a lot of ways between the emotional places we had to go, the physical things that we would have to do. Which is such a gift as an actor. I mean, it was like such a gift.
I feel like Lorena had more of those than most.
She may have, because most of the time she was miserable in, in the flashbacks. It was always, you know, in a lot of ways, it was to serve Bill's story too, to sort of, you know, give us where Bill had come from and his how he was made and how he had spent his first decades as a vampire, and to juxtapose that to how he was living his life now and choosing to live his vampire life now. But for myself, for Lorena, it was all so heart rendering, and it was just so hard. But those flashback scenes were really beautiful, and I always wanted more, of course. I always wanted more of our history. Yeah. I always wanted more. I was always feeling greedy about that, because I just wanted, you know, I wanted more. And I was fascinated by what else happened? What else went on with them? Like, where else did they go?
Well, frankly, I mean, you're my grandmaker and we never even met. I was always like, what would that have been?
You know,
like,
what would that have been?
I know. With Jessica's impulsive nature and all of the drama and misery of her life, I was always like, wow, they might have been a really interesting, like, get into a lot of nasty trouble kind of pair for a while.
I feel like I would have tried to corrupt you.
Yeah.
Most likely. I would have used you somehow to get to Bill. But I feel like I also could have given you some, I don't know, some vampire, you know.
You could have
nuggets of wisdom.
For sure. I feel like Jessica could have filled that void for Lorena. Jessica's very quick to love.
Jessica is quick to love. But I was going to say that you mentioned, Kristen, that most of my scenes were with Steve. And that's true. Yeah. Most of my work in season three, it branched out a little bit. But especially for the first two seasons, it was all Steve all the time. And so... We really got to have a kind of shorthand with each other, which was nice. And he's so funny and so lovely. And even though I was playing
so funny and lovely,
his mommy, in some ways, he felt like a big brother to me, because I was always so nervous being on set and just always felt like I was, you know, screwing up. And he doesn't have that feel. Like, he just feels so calm and comfortable. And he's a director's actor, like, in a way that, I mean, like, he is a director now himself and a very talented one, but he's one of those actors that thinks like a director. I am not. I will never think that way. I always think with my blinders on. I'm always just actor. And he was so great at just, you know, coaxing me to bring my chin up so I was more in the light, or so that the light would hit my tear. And, you know, just like the little technical things that he would always sort of be right there with me to kind of help guide me through. And I'm so grateful for him. He was a lovely scene partner. As much as I wanted to have other scenes with other actors, it was nice. It was nice having all of that journey with him.
Yeah.
And tell us, I have one, I want to talk about hair and makeup and costume. Because holy hell. Now, how do they do the eyebrows when it's just a line? How do they get rid of your eyebrows?
Those eyebrows. So they put a prosthetic to cover my eyebrows.
Because they don't want you to not have eyebrows.
They couldn't actually shave our eyebrows. Yeah. So they made eyebrow prosthetics, but I think it didn't quite look that great. So I think they did have to do some magic, some computer CG magic, and kind of erase some of that. Because then they drew over the prosthetic, the little pencil eyebrows.
Because I was really looking for it. And that makes sense, because there were a couple of moments where I was like, ooh, I can see real eyebrow. And then, no, I couldn't. So that makes sense that they had to help that out.
I think they had to help that out.
That's really challenging.
Yeah. It felt really weird, too, acting. Because it was sort of like half your face was glued, and it was kind of weird. But
Right.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. So Lorena, really, you went through it with stunts, blood, emotions, costumes, hair.
What an amazing character. It was so,
what an amazing character.
What a gift. I was pretty well immersed in the series and in the history. And I kind of looked mostly at Kristen and Alex's performance, and they were just the epitome of cool. Yeah. You know, they were just cool cats who had it all sort of under wraps and with the one-liners. And I thought, how do I distinguish myself coming in as a vampire? I'm already different from Bill, because Bill's sort of his own breed of vampire. Mm-hmm. But I thought, I think she should always be a little unhinged. Not like she's dressed to the nines and looks great, but I always felt like she was a pot with a lid on that was like always almost ready to just blow off. And you never kind of knew what was going to happen, when it was going to happen, what she was capable of. And I liked that about her, that it wasn't, because I felt like the series needed, they didn't need one more cool vampire. They needed, you know, a little something different. So I wanted her to have that quality of being unhinged and a little bit of a question mark.
it's interesting hearing you say it now. Uh-huh. There's that moment you walk into Godric's where you're going to sort of confront Sookie.
Yes,
and I can trying to play, like Lorena trying to be play Eric.
The cool vampire.
But she's just, that isn't who she is. She's in her heart.
And she leaves that scene in tears saying like, why don't you ever love me?
That is another really intense, I mean, you really had, when you came to work, you had some intensity. You didn't. And I'm going to ask you about your training in that a bit. But I wrote down that line where Godric says about Lorena, you're an old vampire, I can tell. You've had hundreds of years to better yourself, and yet you haven't. You're still a savage. Mm. A savage. I fear for all of us, humans and vampires.
I think he's a little vicious.
Savage.
He was vicious, yeah. Yes. But
he's going through his own that depressive end of life thing. He's projecting. projecting a little bit.
No, she did not evolve.
She didn't.
She is savage. I think Godric was on
it.
She is freaking unhinged.
She is. Yeah. Yeah. This is a show and an opportunity to just let it all hang out. Yeah. You got to come to play. And that is what I will say about every actor on that show, even though I didn't get to work with most of them. Everyone came to play and throw down. Like everyone was there to throw down. Nobody was there to like play it cool. And even though we were playing cool a lot of the time, there's a difference between the actor maintaining their coolness or, you know, their whatever, their sense of keeping it together. Like, no, we really had to let it all out. We created a world that people wanted to get in and play around in and be a part of. And that doesn't come around every day. And we were very lucky to have been a part of it.
And when you think of your experience on the show, are there three words that come to mind?
I mean, sadly, the first one is probably nervous, because I just felt so nervous, especially at the beginning, that I was screwing up. And that's just sad to me that's... But to be honest, that is part of it. Tragic, because I just loved her so much and just felt like she was so tragic.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know, man, love. I just loved it. I loved everyone I got to work with. So nervous, you know, tragic love.
My acting teacher. Love.
Amazing.
Nervous, tragic love.
It's a Madonna song.
It is.
Yeah.
Nervous, tragic love.
Well, we are enjoying your performance.
Thank you so much.
So excited for season 3 and everything that comes there.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming.
What a pleasure.
What a pleasure to see you.
I miss your faces.
Oh my gosh, so good to see Mariano. Yeah. I love talking to her. You know, she is so funny. Like when we get together, we laugh and laugh and laugh. She's just such a joy and so smart. Yeah. And she is freaking luminous.
Yeah, and I love that you two have stayed close and continue to share stories and all of that. And in fact, coming up to this interview, I was like, oh, I'm really not that nervous about this one. And I think I texted her, I was like, because she's a great actress and a good egg, you know, like I just know it's going to be a great time.
Said.
And, you know, and it was, I mean, she's luminous, but it's interesting because we think of that as being a physical quality, but it is also lit from within, right? I mean, it's that soul that shines through one's eyes and she has that and you really feel it when you're speaking with her.
That's exactly it. She has that light from within. Yeah. Oh, I know. What a wonderful thing, this podcast.
Next week on Truest Blood, the church is on lockdown and war is brewing. Can a radical act of peace from a 2,000-year-old vampire turn the tide? We'll find out. Plus, vampire regeneration, the good, the bad, and the utterly embarrassing.
And we speak with our dear friend, Michael McMillan, and the one and only Reverend Steve Newlin, which, you know what? I'm just realizing I had a dream about him last night.
No.
And we were somewhere doing something weird and wonderful, and I laughed so hard that it woke me up. That is Michael McMillan. And he's one of those actors that we've all seen everywhere with leading roles on What I Like About You, Hot in Cleveland, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and fan favorite, Beauty in the Briefcase. And he's also a writer and a podcaster, so be sure to listen to Slate Your Name. I did an episode, so did Anna Camp, and Bigfoot Collectors Club for all the McMillan goodness, which Deb and I both did.
I've done an episode.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, he is funny, he's full of heart, and just one of our absolute favorite people. You're going to love it. So thanks for listening, Trubies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now, you hear.
Got any burning questions you want answered on Truest Blood? Post them on any and all social media platforms using hashtag FangClubQuestions, and we may feature them on the show. That's hashtag FangClubQuestions. Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO Max. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galon, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on HBO Max.